Hello and welcome to the fourth of the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward. I'm director of Eastern Arc. And these podcasts are a chance to hear about the work going on at the Eastern Arc universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent. In previous episodes, we've talked about the origin, the spread and the management of coronavirus and where we go from here. We've also heard about networks that are used by our academics to develop their collaborations, particularly across disciplinary areas. Today, we're turning our attention to the symptoms and the testing of coronavirus. And I'm delighted to have on the line three experts from across Eastern Arc who can talk with some authority about this. First of all, Carl Philpott is Professor of Rhinology and Olfactology at the Norwich Medical School at UEA. Dr. Javier Andrew Perez, who's Senior Lecturer in the School of Computer Science at Essex. And Professor Mark Smales, who's Professor of Industrial Biotechnology in the School of Biosciences at Kent. So can I start with you, Mark, with the testing for COVID-19? It has been in the news a lot recently around the government trying to meet its target of 100,000 tests. But can we take a step back from that? And can you explain how we test for COVID-19 and give us a bit of background on it?
Yes, Phil. Well, I'll do my best. So as you said, we've all heard a lot about the testing, the targets. At the moment, the test that most people would have heard about is one which actually looks at targeting or identifying the genetic material of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes the COVID-19 disease. And so all of these, you know, 100,000, 200,000 tests a day or whatever we're trying to match are based around detecting the RNA genetic element of the virus. And, you know, different countries have had different amounts of these tests been running. And it's very much based on something known as the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, which is a bit of jargon that is used in the biological sense. But basically what that allows us to do is the virus itself has a very specific genetic code, or at least part of it. Because of some of the specificity in the sequence of that genetic material, we can use the PCR assay to detect whether somebody currently has the virus or not by detecting their genetic material. Of course, we have to pick out this from the mealy of other microbiota that we have. And that's why this is such a good assay, is because of the specificity of it. So what happens is generally a swab is taken, a nasal swab, where a slightly longer Q-tip type swab will be put either up one or both nostrils right into the back of the throat, where the majority of the initial infection occurs and where you get, you know, an embedding of the infection really in the nasal and respiratory system, to try and take a sample of the material that's there and see whether the genetic material is present. You can take a throat swab as well, but most of these work by taking a nasal swab, which is a little bit uncomfortable. I've never actually had one myself, they are meant to be a little bit uncomfortable, and of course they can make you want to sneeze or cough, which is why it's particularly important that the people actually taking or collecting the swabs are protected, because you could imagine if someone is infected and they're induced to sneeze or cough by this process, you want to protect the person taking the sample. That sample's then taken and processed to try and detect the genetic material. And it's got a high specificity, which means that, you know, we don't get very many false positives, negatives, and is very good at actually detecting the presence of the virus. So you can tell if someone's infected or not. There's a number of other tests people have also heard about, and one there's been a lot of talk about in press and by the government, for example, is the so-called antibody testing, you know, and how this could be a game changer. Now, this doesn't test for the presence of the virus, but it tests potentially for people that have had the virus and recovered from it. And the antibody test actually looks for our own immune system's response to the presence of the virus. And what people have been doing is looking at trying to make proteins on the virus that would normally be seen in the virus itself. And so what that means is if you want to detect antibodies to the virus, you can actually, it's much easier to take a sample here. If you're looking at a blood test, you can take a small amount of blood, serum, etc. And you can either run it in two different formats. One of them is something called an ELISA format. Basically, it allows us to detect whether the person has antibodies in the blood or serum samples. Another is what's called a lateral flow or assay or point of care assay. And this is something people might be a bit more familiar with. Things like the pregnancy test, where you have a small cartridge where you put a sample on, and then you get a line indicating whether you have an antibody or not. And that's the kind of test that they're looking at developing at the moment. Now, one of the issues is that we actually develop different responses as a disease progresses. And because this is a respiratory initially infection, of course, our initial responses will actually be in the mucosal systems. And so you can imagine if you're actually trying to run a blood test, our initial responses may not be picked up in that blood test. And it takes some time. And what they've been finding with the tests is that a lot of these tests become more reliable, when people are 10, 20, 30 days post recovery from infection, because you have your more longer term immune response, which is an IgG response in the blood by then, so you can pick it up. But that IgG response may not be picked up early on. There's another type of antibody, an IgM, in the blood. So generally, a lot of tests are looking at, trying to pick both of these up. Now, one of the things we don't know at this stage is how long that immunity will actually last. And again, that's another thing we'll have to look at developing an understanding on, because although you have that immunity, we need to figure out, is that a long-term immunity that can last for years, or actually will it be a shorter-term immunity? And we really don't know at this stage. What we do
how do we work that out? How do we work out how long immunity lasts?
I mean, we can monitor the presence of the antibodies and whether we continue to have them. Yeah, I mean, there's also a different type of immunity, part of the long-term memory immunity, and that will require us to monitor, over time. One of the good news is, so this original SARS, the indications in the literature are that, people that have recovered from that do maintain immunity for, in cases years has been reported. So, but we will have to wait and see. There is another type of test, and this is where it becomes a little bit confusing, that's also in development. And again, this is to detect the presence of the virus. But instead of using the PCR method I talked about earlier, it is actually to use antibodies to the virus to detect the virus itself. Yeah. So again, this is what we call an antigen test. You're trying to pick up the presence of the virus. And this could again be used to run blood samples, saliva samples. The amount of virus potentially in blood samples is going to be much, much less than in the respiratory system, of course, which is where it's concentrated. But, and there's other people looking at developing other potential tests, but those are the main ones. And the PCR one is kind of the workhorse at the moment there.
So with those other two, the antibody and the antigen tests, has anyone actually developed a reliable one yet, or they're all still very much in development?
There has been a lot of tests. In fact, I have read somewhere that there's more commercially available serological tests, i.e. tests that trying to measure SARS-CoV-2 in the sera, than for any other potential infectious disease, because a lot of these have been sort of rushed through. To date, my understanding is a lot of them haven't been very specific. However, there are some more recent ones that have been released by commercial companies, both in Europe and the US, which do appear to be, potentially a lot more specific. And we'll just have to wait and see how those play out in the coming weeks.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark. Just a final question on that, or two final questions. One is, the reliability of both a PCR test and the other two that you talked about, should they come online, and also the amount of time it takes to hear back the results from both of those or all three tests?
Yes, so those are good questions. So one of the key aspects of any assay is the specificity and sensitivity. And the PCR-based or the test is very high in that regard, and so we have a lot of confidence in that. It does take longer to run, and it's more technically challenging. You couldn't run that in the home, of course, and you need experts to interpret the data. And that's why it does take time to turn these around. Some countries have been incredibly efficient at doing this and talk about turning these around in, you know, 2 to 8 hours. Generally, though, it takes a day or two to turn these around by the time it gets to the swab, gets to a lab, we get the RNA extracted, you run the test, it gets interpreted, etc. So it takes some time. The antibody-based test, the nice thing, particularly about the lateral flow assay, is potentially you can have an answer of those in minutes. You can talk about 5 to 10 minutes if these get up and working. And of course, that would be very useful for being able to track people that have recovered from infection, and potentially can be done at the point of care, i.e. in the home, etc. But generally, you're trying to get obviously as high a sensitivity and specificity with those as possible, but certainly well above 90%, because you can imagine if there's hundreds of thousands of people that need testing, millions of people, something that's a little way off 100% can potentially be a lot of people. Some of the latest tests out, they're claiming very much on or close to 100%.
So thank you very much for that, Mark. That's a really useful overview of where we're at with the testing that already exists, but with the tests that are in development as well. And it sounds like, although there's been an awful lot of effort in developing those tests, we've still got quite a way to go in terms of specificity and assurance that we are being realistic with the findings of them. I want to move on to Javier and his work, because Mark, you mentioned the discomfort that might come from taking swabs and the amount of time it takes to get reliable results back. Javier, can you talk to me a little bit about your current work in developing a different type of test?
Yeah, sure. I follow actually Mark's talk very, I was very focused on it and paying a lot of attention. It was very interesting what he was saying on the test that he's developing. First start, this was developed as a side project of other projects that we had before COVID-19 started. So we were working on other projects that they also require human participants, and of course, because of the lockdown in several countries, so we had to stop the project. And then we saw that with the expertise that we have, how we could help to fight this pandemic. So then we move out to this idea of, let's see if we can start collecting data from coughs, and we have already built a database that allow us already to see, the feasibility of this technology. So I'm going to start with the problem that I think that's why this technology, it's interesting at the moment for the situation where we are. So if you have followed the news recently, UK is now the country that has the highest rate of death in Europe. And one of the causes because of that is that because people are not calling for the emergency services, they are staying at home and they just live on with the disease when they have it. Our contribution to this is that we need something that even before the antibody test or the genetic test, something that would work like a thermometer, just using their mobile phones, just doing a test that will tell them that it won't be actually 100% accurate, or it won't have that precision, neither sensitivity, specificity, or positive predictive rate. But at least it will give a first hint that you could be infected by COVID. And if you also have high temperature, and this time for you to call health services and then get a proper test, antibody, genetic, or some of the tests that Mark has been talking about. So.
Okay, thank you very much. So what you're looking at here is not meant to be a standalone test. It's an indicator for people at home who may be worried and are thinking, should I bother the doctor? Should I bother 999? Should I call for an ambulance? And they have, you know, they take their temperature and they use your app. They cough into your app and it will tell you the likelihood that you may be infected. Have I got that right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, exactly. That's our idea and that's what we are working after.
Okay. Can you tell me how it works then?
So, well, we collected a sample database. We started collecting data in Spain at the beginning of the outbreak. So we got a lot of validated samples from patients from there. And then our hypothesis was that, you know, there is some latent component in the cough, whether in the cough sound or, you know, in the interbreeding between cough that could help us to find some patterns. With the human hearing, it's very difficult. So that's why we rely on advanced techniques of signal processing and artificial intelligence to pick out, to scan all that frequency that comes from the cough and being able to find whether there is a stereotypical pattern that can discern from that specific pulmonary infection or something else different, such as a chest cough or a asthmatic cough or simply something which could be caused by pollution or any sensitivity. So
have you discovered that there is a, as you say, a stereotypical pattern for the COVID-19 cough?
Our initial test in our sample, we are managing to get around 80% accuracy in some of the tests that we have done with our current database. That's not perfect, but it's quite encouraging for us to continue working. Of course, cough are quite affected by many other possible disease that the patient can have, such as any comorbidities and so on. The more data we have, the better we can actually remove the uncertainty. And let's hope that we can get something which, you know, maybe a satisfactory level. So,
And what would you call a satisfactory level?
As I say, we don't expect to get 100%. But I mean, if we are around, we can really confirm around those 80%. I think then that will be a satisfactory level, although that's not something that we'll decide, but our clinical collaborators will be the ones to decide, you know, where is the upper and lower threshold for that.
So how many samples have you collected so far?
So at the moment, the hospitals are doing quite well, 200. But I mean, we are getting a lot from the web, although I mean, that's not data that we can trust 100%. They're not clinically validated. But it's growing and it's going in the right direction.
That's an interesting thought, actually. Mark was talking about the antibody tests and how the test was taken from the blood, but actually the initial infection is more mucosal. So it's almost about timing when you take that test. With the potential of this cough pattern recognition, does the cough change over time during the time the patient is infected, or is it consistent throughout the infection period?
Absolutely. That's a very good point. Actually, one of the issues we have is that the data we get from the hospital, from patients, they have been already diagnosed. They have been for a few days in hospital. So the cough is quite clear and different. It's a very stereotypical pattern of someone who is suffering from this viral infection. However, in the early stage, and when someone is having the early symptoms and hasn't yet reached to the emergency service, that's a key point that we really want to reach and get that data. So we feel that it will be different.
Okay. And just final question, what kind of time frame are you looking for developing this?
The earliest as possible, Phil,
to be honest.
So... I mean, well, we are aiming actually at the beginning, and because some of our colleagues in Spain and the Mediterranean countries, the South Europe, pretty much every day they ask me when this is going to be ready, mostly because now they're actually opening the lockdown. So they are all starting to open business and so on. So they expect that there's going to be another outbreak soon. And, you know, any technology that could, you know, can potentially help them to support this, it will be very helpful. But I mean, science as everything and technology takes time to develop. We're trying to catching up as much as possible and putting as many hours. But, you know, as you said, you know, we wanted to have it as soon as possible, but things, you know, let's say confirm and safe to be used and roll out generally need some time.
And that is a challenge all scientists are facing and all policymakers to a certain extent. They're having to balance the need to be as robust and reliable as possible, but to be as quick as possible as well. And that's a difficult call to make. So just the final question to you, Javier. It sounds like an obvious thing to be doing in some ways, you know, this idea of analyzing the cough. Do you know of others who are working on something similar, or are you alone in the field in developing this?
No, actually, there are other people in other countries that they're trying to actually follow. I mean, this idea of, you know, by cough or voices of people breathing. So the reason why we focus on cough is one, because we found that with this specific data, we were getting some encouraging results. And second, because cough are also anonymous. And when you roll out an app, you need to be also concerned about the privacy of the patient. If you use something such as the camera to monitor the temperature or their voices, then you are also intruding on their privacy.
Absolutely. And that's a big discussion at the moment, isn't it, about the possibilities of the NHS app for contact tracing. Thank you very much, Javier. I'd like to move on to Carl now, because that leads quite naturally in my mind, where we're looking at the symptoms of COVID-19, whether that be the cough, the high temperature, or in Carl's area, the loss of smell. Carl commented on a recent study from King's College, which said that 59% of people who had COVID-19 within the study had reported a loss of smell. Carl, could you say a bit more about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Yesterday, the World Health Organization added smell and taste loss to their list of the official symptoms for coronavirus. So it's been coming around the world in various countries, but now WHO have added it to the list. It has made it feel all the more important to sort of to flag this. Yeah, I mean, it's on a daily basis. There's new information coming in from around the world that increasingly there are lots of people out there experiencing sudden onset of loss of smell and or taste, and I can unpick that a bit for you as the nuances of chemosensory disturbance, but they're clearly sort of very common symptoms. The systematic review that I was involved with that we submitted probably a week and a half ago now sort of had a prevalence of 60% in COVID positive patients, so it's quite a high sort of a level of symptom. And in fact, we've been collecting data from the two local hospitals here in Norfolk amongst healthcare workers. And those that reported smell and taste loss, it was actually more common than fever and cough. And only about a third of those responding reported those two symptoms. What we're seeing is that some people are experiencing smell loss and don't have any other symptoms at all. Some people are experiencing smell loss and then get the other symptoms, and some get it sort of with the other symptoms. So there's a kind of mixed sort of pattern of presentation. I guess for those who get it in isolation or before other symptoms, the key thing is really that it's an opportunity to identify people who are at risk of transmitting the virus before the thing becomes fully blown, and to allow them to self-isolate and to stay at home. And that's particularly obviously pertinent with healthcare workers, because they could be going back in and not only infecting their colleagues, but infecting currently uninfected patients with their version of the coronavirus. So we're part of this global survey, the GCCR, Global Chemosensory Research Consortium. And we've now, I think, got approaching 30,000 respondents around the globe that participated in that survey. The limitation we have, with all these things, is back to the issue of testing. And of course, when you look at the numbers that have been tested amongst those that are reporting disturbances, I think so far around the 4,500 of that sample in the global survey that have actually been tested. And certainly in our healthcare worker data locally, we're looking at about sort of, I think, 20% of those that have responded have actually been tested. So there's obviously so much sort of information you can extrapolate from that. But if I think about smell loss due to viruses, which I see a lot of in clinical practice normally, the suddenness of the onset that we're seeing in the current situation is the stark contrast to what we'd normally see with viral smell loss. So typically a sort of viral smell loss, people experiencing all the symptoms of a common cold, and then they appreciate that the other symptoms start to fade and disappear, and suddenly they're aware that actually they still can't smell anything afterwards, and that persists. The classical example for the coronavirus situation, and my anaesthetic colleague described this very pertinently. He said he got up one morning, he made his coffee, he could smell the coffee, and about 2 hours later, it just, everything had gone. And it was just this instantaneous sort of loss of the senses. And that's really the key thing that seems to be standing out about the way that the coronavirus is impacting the sense of smell particularly.
That seems surprising that the loss of smell is so sudden. And you talked about the fact that we do lose our sense of smell quite often when we have other viral infections. Do you know whether that was the same with SARS, or is this quite unusual with coronavirus?
Yep, so the coronavirus family have been previously been reported as being responsible for viral smell loss, and studies that have looked to what are the viruses that cause these problems. Coronavirus family have accounted about 10 to 15% of the kind of viruses that can cause these problems. So it's not new that this coronavirus is doing that. I think it's just the sort of suddenness of the and the frequency of which is doing it, which is most remarkable.
You mentioned, I saw that you'd written an article in The Conversation at the end of March about this. And you said at the time, and I think I've got this right, that there was no hard evidence about the link. Is there hard evidence now? You talk about WHO adding it to the list and there being increasing studies and so forth. Is that connection now made? It's no longer just a correlation.
Yeah, I think at the time I wrote the study, it was a lot of anecdotal reporting, and now the volume of data that's pouring in, it's hard to kind of say this is because of the sort of seasonal viruses going around. You know, it's the what we're seeing and the pattern of what we're seeing. So I think it'd be very difficult to refute that now. Obviously, it'd be great to get sort of more and more data on people who are tested. I think the other thing that's sort of important to pick out is that the people we're seeing that reporting this are the mild to moderately symptomatic cases. Now, that may be a reporting bias because I suspect that those people who are getting more severely affected end up with respiratory problems, end up in hospital and potentially on ventilators. Probably the last thing they're worried about is reporting loss of smell or taste when they can barely breathe. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, if they don't then recover, then we never get information around whether they lost their smell or taste at the beginning, unless they told someone else in their family.
That's interesting. So it could be a lot higher than 60%. It's just that some aren't reporting.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
I can see this as the fact that WHO have added it to the list. The more symptoms we have, the more that people can self-identify as having COVID-19 and can actually either get help or self-isolate or both. Thinking practically about it, Javier mentioned the development of an app towards it. Is there any kind of development building on this finding of this additional symptom?
Yeah, the American ENT Society have had their sort of self-reporting tool, which is sort of an app they've been using. And the you mentioned a study at King's College London, and they've got this sort of COVID tracker app, which has obviously picked up the first really sort of bit of data picked up in the UK to answer on that. We're looking at running a study that will recruit some of these healthcare workers and actually sort of send them some scratch and sniff smell test kits so we can get a bit harder data around the loss. One of the problems with smell loss and the reporting of it is that there's a poor correlation between what people think they're experiencing and actually what you get when you do a test. And there's also a gender bias, and women appear to be much more bothered about losing their sense of smell than men do. And our local healthcare data, I mean, 90% of the respondents are female. And I don't want to go as far to say as that women seem to be only predisposed to losing their sense of smell, but they seem to be more bothered about it. And I know that from my own clinical practice, because every time I do a smell and taste clinic session, you know, two out of three people that turn up are women. So there's a gender bias towards how people feel about smell.
There's current talk about this being an unprecedented opportunity to collaborate across universities and between commercial organisations. Have any of you had experience of being approached by others who you wouldn't normally collaborate with? Are the usual barriers between your work and others coming down? Carl, can I go to you first?
Yeah, I mean, I think although you wouldn't wish a pandemic upon the world or a sensory loss that has long been a pariah among sensory losses itself, to have this sort of highlight the senses of smell and taste, you know, in some ways been a beneficial thing, and seeing this global consortium come together, which has sort of brought together people from around the globe and often in some countries that I haven't sort of had any particular collaborations with before, it's been a great sort of sense of community around that, I think. Mm-hmm. And great to see a collective purpose on that, and I do hope that going forwards it will put the spotlight on olfactory disorders for the benefit of those that experience them in the future. It's been a very, very positive thing from that point of view.
Mark, can I ask you about your work with the Quadrum and collaborating with them?
Yes, I mean, that has arisen directly as a result of work previously done by Simon Carding up at the Quadrum, where he's developed a technology based on these bacteria that make these structures, and these bacteria live in the gut. And Simon has used this to make a vaccine for that he's tested for influenza, for example, not in humans, but it's shown promise, and also one for plague as well. And we're using the same technology, aligned with some work that Martin Warren shared between Quadrum and Kent, for allowing us to link some of the proteins that the coronavirus makes onto these vesicle structures that will allow these to be presented to our immune system. And the nice thing about these is this approach will be particularly good, potentially eliciting an immune response in the respiratory system in the very early places where the infection occurs. So it may be that this offers a different approach to some of the other vaccines which are out there in development, which are looking at the sort of more long-term IgG type response that we'd see in the blood, for example, and might give us, of course, this is all theoretical at this stage, but might give us a sort of first defense in the respiratory system. And so what's been nice is we've had a group of people come together because we have different technologies that we can merge from across the Eastern Arc, but also we have colleagues up at University of Liverpool and in Public Health England as well that are involved in this, really coming together as a consortium. And it does demonstrate the power of bringing people across the community, and in this case, the Eastern Arc, with some additional collaborators to address, you know, real needs that we couldn't do individually. And we're quite excited about it, making good progress. I've also just had an email come in while we've been talking, actually, from another industrial collaborator looking at making diagnostic tests using some of these same reagents that are showing very promising outputs. And again, although we have worked with these collaborators in the past, this has really brought forward sort of interactions and a willingness to exchange ideas and forget about sort of IP and disclosure, non-disclosure events, but, you know, just get on and try and address these things, which has been really refreshing.
Absolutely. Being refreshing is a positive that has come out of this, having people being willing to work differently and being open to working differently, even internationally. I mean, Javier, you talked about working with colleagues in the south of Europe, Spain and so forth. It does feel like an international effort.
Yeah, because, I mean, to be able to cope with all of these comorbidities, kind of being able to collide these databases as big as possible, and actually because the reading of the pandemic is taking in every country is different, so we have to actually contact our colleagues internationally. But, I mean, I think also by, you know, this discussion here locally and even today, I'm learning things. And I think also local collaboration between ourselves, you know, our university, it will be very interesting. So I learned today much about, you know, what Carl has said, and this is possibly another correlate that we will add to our survey when we are collecting coughs. So, yeah, I think international is important, but also putting together all of this expertise that we have locally is a great thing to do, and probably the right way of doing it.
That's a great point to end on, to recognize and value collaboration and the benefits it brings to our own work, but also the common endeavor to find solutions to today's intractable problems. So I just wanted to end by saying thank you so much to all of you, to Professor Mark Smales from the University of Kent, from Dr. Javier Andro Perez from Essex, and Professor Carl Philpott from UEA for taking the time to talk to me today to discuss their findings and the research and their next steps. Thank you all for taking part. Thanks to everyone involved in creating this podcast. And I want to give special thanks to Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin, who produced the music. And thanks to you for listening. I hope you can join me next time when we continue to explore the research which is hosted by Eastern Arc.